I wanted to also talk with both of you about the necessity defense as a legal strategy. There were the four Catholic workers, valve turners we followed, including one in Minnesota. And it's a long road, a long rocky road to pursue those cases, and the costs are high on many levels. But there's been a lot of community support around those cases. And yet, it does involve claiming innocence by way of the necessity and meeting the criteria that are established by the courts. Of course, one of them is the emphasis on nonviolent actions, a history of exhausting alternatives, and you have to present a portrait of pretty extreme virtue to prevail at all in these cases. And yet they've been really important in bringing the logic of justice into these criminal cases. A lot of people understand very quickly kind of the face validity of a necessity defense. It has a beautiful logic to it. Carrie, can you start by commenting on where we are with the use of the necessity defense? And then, Claire, I'd like your thoughts as well.
Well, this might be blasphemy for somebody employed by the Climate Defense Project, but I actually try as hard as I possibly can to talk my clients out of raising the necessity defense at every opportunity. I have attempted to raise it unsuccessfully in a couple of cases in a couple different jurisdictions, including for some clients who were arrested as part of the No Coal, No Gas movement to shut down the last major coal-fired power plant in New England, in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Also, unsuccessfully attempted to raise it in Clearwater County, Minnesota, for a water protector who was charged with obstructing legal process, holding onto the fence outside a pump station. The majority of the time, what happens is, at least in my personal experience, you tell the judge that you want to raise it. They say, "What are you talking about?" You file an extensive memorandum. And then they say, "Nope, you're not allowed to raise it." And then at trial subsequently, they are even more aware and averse to any kind of moral arguments coming in. And the prosecutor often repeats, "You're just trying to get around the necessity defense." So they actually get stricter on the standard of relevance when you've tried and failed in the same proceeding previously to fight for your right to raise the necessity defense. And relevance, excuse my legalese, it's the standard for when evidence can come in. Evidence has to be relevant to the issues of a case in order to be presented at trial.
I wanted to just respond to your points. I think it's not blasphemy. It's reality that these are very difficult cases, admittedly. But what I felt was not part of the coverage of the valve turner cases that I wanted to draw out in the first necessity film was the brilliance of the strategy itself and the scope of it, and how the organizing community mobilization around a coordinated four state action spread across four states, cutting off valves to bringing tar sands into the US. There were communities all along those four states involved. They did community events in organizing around. That's how I learned about it here in Portland. So I think it's to have a fair test of it, you would have to look at it as a broader coordinated grassroots strategy rather than just one person locking themselves down and then trying it out in court. I don't mean to dismiss that, but I think the level of organization around these cases, even the one here in Portland, it was phenomenal. What was involved and people being out there in the street supporting it. Claire, you have any thoughts on that, the strategy?
I will say first that I do believe in a diversity of tactics, that is how we make our movements stronger. But beyond that, I will say that I personally very strongly believe that the best we can do in the courts is harm reduction. And unfortunately, we often have this glorification of court cases as an avenue for change. And that is simply false. For example, Brown v. Board of Education, decided in 1954, is often heralded as this amazing case that resulted in integration of schools. But schools were not integrated for a decade until 1964 and the Civil Rights Act and the feds getting involved and people seeing what was happening in the South on television and all of the organizing that was happening behind all of that. And so while court cases can sometimes be an avenue for organizing, they can be a locus for organizing. And as you've said, there are certainly examples of people using a court case to do the organizing work outside. I think that it's important to note that the change never happens inside the courtroom. The change is happening because of the organizing that's happening outside. And I think that we actually do ourselves a disservice when we limit our organizing and the creativity with which we approach organizing to organizing solely around court cases, particularly criminal court cases.
But isn't that what it means to be a movement lawyer? Kira, if you want to comment.
Yes, I would love to. I think that what you're saying is completely true about organizing always amplifying a message, and that relationship building and coordination is always a good way to make whatever you're doing more impactful and stronger, and to put that message out there. I think with the necessity defense in particular, the bottom line question is, what narrative are you amplifying? And is that a narrative that we as movement-minded people, regardless of whether or not we're lawyers, should be staying behind? So thinking about the necessity defense as exactly what you named it as, it's a framework for saying this group of people are innocent. And the innocence framework in and of itself is violent. The innocence framework in and of itself tries to create, again, a false dichotomy of people who are pure, perfect victims, good, and people who are bad, disposable, evil criminals. And that framework in and of itself is something we should be saying, no, we're not going to play into that. We're not going to participate in that. Rather than saying, let's keep these people outside of the category of criminal, we should challenge criminality as a concept, as a tool of the settler colonial racial capitalist state of positing certain categories of people as bad and disposable.
Even if you didn't go that far and stayed with the violent, nonviolent distinction, which has been a topic of endless debate, certainly throughout my lifetime as a politically conscious person. Is that part of what you're describing here? Is it does rest on even some of the technical criteria for establishing what it means to be nonviolent, like is a property crime violent? Is that part of what you're suggesting here, that it accepts the premise that any form of violence is criminal?
I don't think that it's about violence or nonviolence. I think it's about the fact that the police and prison industrial complex and the courts that provide them the platform to continue to exist and to justify their existence through running people through it and locking them up, that those systems are violent. And that when we voluntarily engage in the court system and expect justice to come out of it, we're legitimizing that system and the violence it promotes. And it's not about putting on our fanciest suit and playing this fundamentally biased game as best as we can. It's about talking to each other, having conversations without the limits that the court, through rules such as relevancy, puts on the conversations we're trying to have. But instead having conversations outside of the courtroom without those limits about what is causing harm, what does safety and security look like, and how can we build a better world together, rather than asking the courts for a tiny scrap of legitimacy that inherently reinforces their role as the decider of right and wrong in the first place, when we actually know that that system really only exists and has only ever existed to protect rich, white, wealthy people's ability to concentrate property and a monopoly on state violence.
But of course, you're having to advise people who engage in what the state determines to be illegal acts. And a lot of the history of civil disobedience as a legal strategy is to draw out the violence of the state, to expose it through putting that violence onto the state. There's always this dilemma, though, how you engage in actions that are going to invite the brutal repression of the state. Claire, what are your thoughts?
I think that there's a difference between drawing out the violent hypocrisies of the state and taking that a step further and saying that the answer to those harms and violences is to actually give the system an opportunity to correct itself and maintain its legitimacy rather than pushing for something bigger that recognizes the power always inherently remains with the people. You know, you had mentioned the role of movement lawyers. I think that there are many movement lawyers who put on a suit and believe that they are the leaders of the cause for justice with a capital J. And I think that those movement lawyers do so much harm because they are the movement lawyers who are convincing their clients that the movement lawyer is the key to success and the courts are the avenue to get there. And I think that the best lawyers are the ones who recognize that we would rather be doing something else too. I would love to organize myself out of a job. I would love for not only activists, but people of color, low-income communities to no longer be policed to such an extent that lawyers like myself and Kira are needed en masse to try to protect people from this crushing grind of the criminal system.
Like emergency room doctors who have a very big role to play in our healthcare system.
Right. You'd rather that we have a healthcare system where people are able to access primary care so that they're not needing the ER doctors in the first place. And I will also say, too, you know, one of the best organizers that I know and one of my very dear friends is in prison. And he has been doing amazing, amazing organizing work in prison. But at the end of the day, he will put anyone who wants to glorify prison right in their place because the prison system is doing everything that it possibly can to undermine his organizing. And they have so much more power to do it when you're on the inside. And he will tell anyone who will listen to him, don't put yourself in a position where you're voluntarily going to prison. You're going to be able to achieve so much more, whatever your organizing goals are, if you're on the outside.
And then thinking about legal strategies in going forward, I'd like to have some of each of your thoughts on the terrain ahead. We're celebrating, of course, this week that the judge's ruling for the Montana youth case, and a lot of hopes and promises are on that front. Also caveats about what can be expected from a successful ruling. What would you both say about the legal strategies and this diversity of tactics that you both have emphasized in closing today? I know part of what you're saying is stay out of the court system as much as you can, but of course, being an activist, particularly involved in radical tactics, confrontational tactics, does mean entering the court system. And also you both emphasize speaking to the community where you live and understanding what your action is communicating, what is the story you're trying to tell, and who's the audience. Kira, do you have closing thoughts?
Sure. As far as legal strategies go, I think that the best legal strategy would be to act preventatively so that you're not stuck in the coercive situation of trying to come up with a legal strategy in the first place. And I see that being accomplished by working on three things. The first being political education. So developing a theory of change, figuring out how to get from the world we're in to the world we want. Understanding the court system, not only intellectually, but internalizing it in our hearts as a place where we are set up to lose every time we go there, and we shouldn't be voluntarily escalating our engagement with the courts, expecting justice to come out of it. I think, like Claire was saying, for me, the internalization of that learning has come from deep, intimate friendships with people who are not choosing to go to prison, but who are stuck there. So I noticed that a lot of my clients who are choosing to risk arrest, in particular, white college-educated clients, don't have close family or friends who are incarcerated. They are the example for their community of what the court system is like, rather than going to court with an internalized understanding of how violent it is. And I think that needs to change. So political education, building connections with communities who are already criminalized and not by their choice. The second thing I think is trauma healing. I think that we get ourselves in a lot more legal trouble than we need to be because we're not taking care of ourselves. And I'm guilty of that too. Like, I notice myself doing cop watching and losing a little control and putting myself or friends and comrades at legal risk because I'm scared and I haven't done the work to really make sure I'm in the movement, like, as the best healed, most healed person I can be, rather than using the movement as a proxy for healing. I think that a lot of us are seeking notoriety or seeking,
There's some
a
drama
moment
there.
of, there's drama, totally. Yeah, there's a lot of us are working against each other because we're people living in a really violent culture and we're all a little bit broken and we're making it harder than it needs to be, rather than trying to build something like nurturance culture where we're actually like, nobody needs to prove their worth by getting arrested or making themselves into a martyr. So doing that trauma healing really means that we can not have to get arrested because we're just a little bit able to take a deep breath and act more intentionally. And I think that the third thing, which is related to the other two, is just relationship building, and that we're not going to be in as much of harm's way when we have the kinds of deep care-based relationships where we can give each other feedback on strategies, where we can say, hey, we don't need to do that, or hey, this is how we could be acting differently or better towards each other. Whether that's talking about a legal strategy, encouraging our buddies to take that sweetheart plea deal, and or encouraging people to do more effective, more powerful movement building actions that don't involve raising the necessity defense, for example. I'll just leave it at that.
As some of what you're describing has been also more associated with feminist practices, the shadow labor of movements, work that's less apt to be lionized or cast in heroic terms, that is more of of women's work historically in movements. Claire, your final thoughts.
I think my final thoughts are to resist the silo, whether it's the criminal system, whether it is ego, whether it is martyrdom, whether it's lawyers who want to have their name in a headline. All of that is antithetical to the broader goal. We're not saying that there aren't people who end up in the criminal system for a variety of reasons that you have to, plead out at any cost. I certainly don't want listeners to have that takeaway, because I also think that there are many, many ways to be subversive when you are caught within the criminal system's jaws.
No simple formula for this.
Right, exactly. It's very complicated, but it becomes less complicated when you have strong community that is able to help guide your goals and help connect you to broader community goals and movement goals. And one of the most powerful anecdotes that I have about this, as a new public defender to this role, I had a group of co-defendants that I was representing all of them. And that in itself was very scary to me because public defenders, we follow ethics in that we never represent co-defendants. And then this group of clients kept asking me, how are you going to achieve our goals? And I'll say, well, what is your goal? And they would say, our goal is solidarity. And I would say, well, I don't know what that means, but we can work it out. And we had conversations about what solidarity means and what solidarity looks like. And this group of defendants actually had quite a diversity of risks, right? You had people who were in much more dangerous situations because they were charged with felonies. You had people in much more dangerous situations because of their identities, because they were people of color, because they were trans or gender nonconformist, and that would subject them to much more violence in the system if they were convicted. You had young people where a more serious conviction would really impact their ability to, earn a living, et cetera, achieve whatever goals they have for their future. And then on the other hand, I had clients who had a much lower risk in this group, who were retirees, who didn't really care what was on their record, who were faced with misdemeanors, who were white and didn't have the vulnerabilities that other people in the group had. And this group said, you know what? We are going to stand together and demand that none of us are going to accept this sweetheart plea deal until it is extended to all of us. Because the prosecutors were singling out the most vulnerable people. They were not being extended sweetheart deals in the same way that, cis white retired men with no criminal record were being offered. And everyone banded together and said, none of us accepts the deal unless all of us get offered the deal. And it took months of posturing and negotiating and making very clear to the prosecutor that they were going to have to go through 20 trials, one by one by one, if they didn't extend this sweetheart offer to everyone. And ultimately, the prosecutor caved. And it was an immense success. And it had nothing to do with my litigation skills. And it had everything to do with the solidarity of defendants who refused to be siloed and demanded to remain in community with each other. And that is how I think we have success, whether we're in the criminal legal system or not.
It's a wonderful story. Actually, in the First Necessity film, Tara Houska describes a similar story of defendant solidarity that was critical, I mean, think from an indigenous perspective, to what it really means to be a white ally in a movement where indigenous people were suffered the most brutal repression. Well, in closing, is there a way that listeners can support the work there? What would you tell listeners about how they can support this work?
I would say one of the most important things that people can do that is relatively accessible is to just get informed about what's happening in your own backyard. What are the organizing fights that are happening, and what's happening in the court system? Oftentimes, court watchers are like neocons who are watching court to make sure that, so-called criminals are being sanctioned harshly. But we've actually, in recent years, seen this beautiful organizing work around liberatory court watching of people who are watching court to hold judicial actors accountable, law enforcement, prosecutors. And as people become increasingly aware of how unfair and unjust the system is, I encourage you to go to your local courthouse and ask where criminal court is happening and sit down for a few hours or a few days and just see, because it doesn't take long to see that things are wrong. And then talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, get other people involved and see what kind of organizing work you can do to make things better.
Hira, anything you'd like to add to that call?
I would agree with everything Claire said, and in particular, appreciate the emphasis on doing court watch for people who didn't choose to get arrested. We really don't need to like go to court for the purpose of having an educational experience when there are people already in court whose own coercive experience could be made better through accompaniment. So we can get prison pen pals if you want a prison pen pal. Some friends and I run a collective Letter by Letter Vermont, New Hampshire. We have a blog. You can Google us. Happy to match you with somebody and read up on abolitionist organizing. Miriam Kava, Angela Davis, Ruth Wilson Gilmore are all fantastic authors to learn from and to really try to practice that in our communities, in our personal relationships, and prefigure the world we're trying to live in, totally outside and unrelated to the courtroom.
So you have a very intersectional analysis of climate justice movement as part of a broader racial justice movement and abolitionist movement as well. Thank you so much for being with us today, Claire Glenn and Kira Kelly, I hope to have you on the show again. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.